Let's go. All right.
Okay. Then it makes sense. It flows 1, 2, 3, 4. So I had pre-folded a whole bunch and we don't know where they're at. But here are these. So it is
say the black, do the red.
There you go. That's pretty much what this is. But this, so I have lots of these. If you want more, let me know. But this is the cheat sheet for math.
Now you guys probably know this, but the reason why we genuflect is we are genuflecting to the real presence, which we notice because there's usually a candle, usually a red candle that we can see. In the cathedral, that candle is about 13 feet up in the air over to the right. But that big gold brass thing that's in the middle of the high altar is the tabernacle where the reserved sacrament is kept. So when we come into the church, that's why we genuflect. We go down on our right knee and then we go get in our pew. You'll also see servers reverence the altar during Mass as they walk back and forth. Yes?
So when exactly are we supposed to genuflect?
When we come in and we go out. Okay. I'm getting to what we do when we're passing by, okay? So some kind of reverence is made when we're moving around. You see altar servers and priests do that, right? They generally bow like that as they come and go. They have some little rules, like if you're carrying something, don't do it. Some little kid's going to burn his face if he does that with a candle in his... and then you frequently see people when they... In our church, we still have it. The altar rail is that stone fence-looking thing. And inside that is the sanctuary. Back in the Middle Ages, the church courts were more lenient than the king's courts. So if you were a robber and you could get into church and get in the sanctuary, so in behind the altar rail, then the bishop would hear your case, not the king, and you'd probably get off better. So people go into the sanctuary, you'll see some of them will genuflect, others will bow, but some kind of reverence as they go into that more sacred place. Just in case you didn't know, the part where we sit, if you look up, especially in our church, but in a lot of churches, there are the beams going back and forth, and they're typically in a like this. If you turn it upside down, it would look like the ribs in a church, which is why it's called the nave. Ribs in a boat, which is why it's called the nave. We get the word navy from it. It's the Greek, the Latin word novice. Okay, so we are the people in the boat going to heaven, right? Okay, so that's one. Yes, ma'am.
You know, I see a lot of people hearing the Our Father praying mm-hmm. like this, and I read the other day that that's against the rubrics of the Mass. That we're supposed to just...
Well, when I talk to the altar servers, and I would say it to the extraordinary ministers if I could. If you're on that side of the altar rail and you come in shorts and you do this, we love you. If you're a minister, this is the orans position. This is the praying position, which is reserved to the priest. So the reason why, like you'll see me at Mass, I have my hands like this. I don't want any confusion about who the priest is. This is one of those things where in updating from Vatican II, a lot of individual magisteriums were born, and they decided, well, this is what I want to do, so I'm going to do it, okay? But I would agree that the best thing for altar servers and everyone else up there to do would be to hold their hands like this and let Father pray like that. But I'm not going to, you know, there's no penalty. Yes?
I agree with her. I read that recently, but I think how that was born out was in a lot of churches,
they did.
And so it's a natural gesture to do this, but then when people stopped doing that, they just kept doing this, but it's not.
There's a lot of reasons. There's also, I mean, look at our brothers in the Protestant church. You know, they get their hands up and they're saying, "Hallelujah, Jesus." Well, I want some of that, right? Because I got tricked into thinking that this wasn't reverent and holy and beautiful, okay? So part of what we're doing as Catholics is recognizing that all of this stuff is just stuff. This is real. If Shaquille O'Neal stood next to you, his 7-foot-2-ness and his 330-poundness would be a factor in you just kind of being still and quiet, right? That's the appropriate posture when we are in the presence of God. It's not about us. So some of this is I love Jesus, and some of it is I want something to do. Yes, sir. I think the honest answer is, at some point we stopped using a hymnal with a missal in it, because the different masses have a different tone, and I think they've just so much paper. So if I'm going to put the song in, what prayer am I going to have to take out? Some of the print they've gotten down to is so small it might as well not be in there. But I think that the main thing is just the reality of I'm going to do it in a threefold, and I just can't fit that. I figured you knew the Hail Mary, and maybe that was the wrong decision. Yes. Right, right. That's right. That's right. That's not actually part of it. That's a tradition. We use tradition, and I think Ben's going to talk about this, so I don't want to. But we use tradition sometimes with a capital T, meaning it has authority, and sometimes with a lowercase T, saying, well, we just always done it that way here, and we have to distinguish. Yes, ma'am. He does. He doesn't really come under the Pope. Yes, that's right. He doesn't come under the Pope. He is in communion with the Pope. So when the bishops get together, now, obviously, over the ages, different popes had different attitudes about that. So we are now in the position where Archbishop Gregory got named to this seat by the Pope, by John Paul II. Okay, but back in the day, I think St. Augustine got made bishop of Hippo because the people of Hippo said, guess what, buddy, you're going to be our bishop. So the tradition isn't exactly the same and unchanged forever and everywhere. In the sort of established church now, it's done the nuncio, in the Pope's representative in America collects files on good guys who might be good bishops, and then some recommendation is made, but there's nothing to prevent the Pope from saying, I don't want to do that, I want to do this. Okay, so, and they don't tell us how they did it. We just find out that that's our bishop, okay? But Archbishop Gregory is the head guy for this area, and the Pope is only going to come in when somebody appeals and says, I am not being treated fairly by my bishop, and I appeal to the Bishop of Rome. But he doesn't call up Francis and say, hey, I'm thinking about doing this, is it okay? He's not like a vice president to a president. It's more like brothers around the table. Does that help? Okay. Okay, so now, it turned out you guys all had liturgies in your families. He's the Pope's representative here.
Ambassador of the Pope to the United States. So basically that complaint would go up to him.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure, but there are things like, you noticed that we had a series of new priest appointments around there, and if you notice, some of them were listed as administrators and some were listed as pastors. If you're the pastor, you can't just get pushed out by your bishop. You have rights, okay? So if your bishop is abusing his power over you, you go talk to the next step up, and it may go through the nuncio, it may go directly, I'm not 100% sure. But the Rome only steps in when we're being unreasonable, okay? Whether it's we as a community, or we as just the bishop, or we as a particular priest, okay? Because you have When we talked about church, you're as much part of church as any priest or deacon or bishop, okay? And so you have the same rights. You have different activities, but you have the same rights. Okay? All right. So now we've been ducking this, but we're still going to cover it because this is important. The world doesn't think this way, and that's a lot of words. The world mostly thinks this way, so I thought I would go through it to make sure you have a feel for it. And I need to have my notes for this because, okay. Jesus says, I am the truth, the way, and the life, right? So all truth comes from him. Some truths are only accessible to us because he just gave it to us, okay? We saw the burning bush. That's revelation, right? I am. Deal with it, right? Okay. An example of a revelation is the Trinity, okay? What does the Trinity say? One God, three persons. You can look at a three-leaf clover all day long, and you're not going to figure it out, right? You know? You can't say, well, I go to God through Jesus. I go to God through the Holy Spirit. That's not true, because they're all equally God, and yet they're one, and yet they're three. Cuckoo, ka-choo, right? It's a mystery that we cannot figure out ourselves. That's eternal law given to us through revelation. There's other eternal law that we can kind of reason to, and we call that natural law. You don't need God to know that murder is evil. You can just figure it out. You don't need God to know that adultery is wrong. You can just figure it out. And people who aren't Christians and aren't Catholics agree with these things, okay? So we can use our reason. One of the Christian fundamental principles is that God is reasonable. Good Catholics would look at all of the developments of science and say, it is because God created an ordered, and reasonable doesn't mean fair, it means I can use my mind, rational, okay? Created an ordered and reasonable universe such that Isaac Newton could discover the law of gravity, okay? If God's was just completely arbitrary, then this stuff would fly all over the place, right? Because there wouldn't be a law of gravity. But God created an ordered universe. That's why we know the sun goes up and it goes down, and we can count the days and all that kind of stuff. So there's an awful lot of God's truth that we can reason to. So we need a framework for reasoning. And the ancient Greek philosophers loved this stuff. You've heard of Socrates and Plato and Aristotle. I hope you have. That's where Aristotelian comes from. And they were pagans, but they were trying to categorize things and organize things so they could understand the world that they found themselves in. And this is kind of the key. So that's Aristotle. And then St. Thomas Aquinas, that's where you get Thomism from. St. Thomas Aquinas took the newly rediscovered writings of Aristotle and applied them to questions of theology. So he kind of systematically went through the questions of the faith and wrote out answers. And that, if you've ever heard of the Summa Theologica, that was his big book where he kind of went through in this ordered way. And the recipe he used is the one developed by Aristotle. So if you've ever read the Summa, you're like, huh? Because there's a formula. I'd say this, then I do this, then I do this, then I say on the other hand, and then I do this, and I come to the answer, okay? But the basis of Aristotle and Thomistic thinking is that things are real. They're not just ideas. They're actually real. Not everything is tangible, but things are real, and we can classify them. So, what's that? What's that? What's that? What's that? Okay, so I'm Aristotle. I wandered around and I saw those things and I said, you know what that is? Those, each of those is a three-sided figure. If I add up the interior angles, that's gonna come to 180 degrees every single time. You know what? I think I have found a thing. and I'm going to call it a triangle. Now, I had a red triangle, I had a right triangle, I had an isosceles triangle, I had a white triangle, I had a blue triangle, but they're all triangles. So the essence of it, the substance is the Latin word we use, is it's a triangle. Its features, its accidents, are red, its shape, its size, how it sits, those types of things, okay? So in Catholic theology, and Helen mentioned St. Anselm, theology is our faith seeking understanding. So we know it's true, we're just trying to use reason to put a good wrapper on it, okay? So we know that that stuff, after the priest has prayed over it, is now Jesus, the body, blood, soul, divinity of Jesus Christ. But it looks like bread and wine. It tastes like bread and wine. It chews like bread and drinks like wine. Well, that's when we say the substance, what it truly is, changed. The accidents, what it looks like, remain the same. So when you hear the word transubstantiation, that is an effort to try to explain a mystery in a reasonable, a rational framework, okay? So that's, I can now go through everything and categorize them. I can kind of isolate what it truly is. I can then distinguish its characteristics, and I can make sense of all of creation, okay? And I will point out that this thing, you can't touch a triangle, can you? If you don't like triangles because they remind you of the fact that your father cheated on your mother and there were 3 points to that whole relationship and it just makes you angry every time you think of the word triangle, it remains a triangle. Okay? So it separates how I respond to stuff from what it truly is. So this emphasizes the objective dimension of reality. Okay? William of Ockham was another intellectual monk in Ockham, which I think is in England. And this is back when, you know, we didn't have graduate students that we do now that had to publish papers. All the monks did that, I guess. But he came along and he said, nuh-uh. There's no such thing as a universal concept called a triangle. Those are just names that we give them, okay? This is cool until you have to kind of go through life. And then you say, well, what truly is versus how I respond to it? This is very powerful in the sense that my response to the thing becomes central to defining it. So this emphasizes the subjective dimension of reality and truth, okay? And the reason I bring this up is because today in the world, not necessarily just Catholics versus Protestants, but Catholics versus the world, marriage. What is marriage? Okay. What the Catholic Church says is marriage is a partnership of the whole life ordered to the good of the spouses and the rearing and education of children. And its properties are unity and indissolubility. If that sounds like I was quoting canon law, that's what I was doing. Okay. We've defined what marriage is. The world doesn't say that, do they? What the world says is, if two girls or two guys want to get together and call what they have marriage, who are you to get in their way? Isn't that pretty much what the world says? Nobody's nodding. I hope I'm okay. All right. And when we say, well, not exactly, the next thing the world says is you're haters, doesn't it? Okay. This is us pointing out that marriage means something. It has an objective definition. We recognize that people have inclinations, desires, compulsions, preferences that don't correspond, but that doesn't. We don't get to redefine the term. The term is the term. There are universals. That's the way the church approaches questions of morality and theology, is in an ordered way. And I thought marriage is a good example to highlight the challenge, because how is this guy going to talk to this guy, right? And we've seen in some of the cases in the newspaper, you end up power, right? If I'm not going to agree to use your terminology, if I've got enough votes, I'm just going to force you to do what I want you to do, right? And if I'm losing, I'll try to find some way to get more votes than you do. We had the Baker or whatever that was in Colorado, right, where they just said, no, you have to do it even though you disagree. We have the Sisters of the Poor Clares who were forced. Okay, this is a celibate female order for nuns who are forced by the government to offer birth control to their health care plan. Yeah. So, because that's the way they want it. There's no such thing as the terms, universal terms, it's just what we want to call things. So as you're going through questions that come up to you in your faith, and you realize how you react to it, that's very important, okay? He's not entirely wrong, but this really has to trump. When we go to Mass, we go to meet Jesus. So if I'm not getting anything out of Mass, that whole sentence is a little bit wrong. I need to worship and adore Jesus in the Mass, and I will discover, if I do that faithfully, I get a lot out of the Mass. But if I go to Mass saying, I didn't get anything out of the Mass, I'm actually going to Mass in the wrong posture. If I go into marriage thinking, what am I going to get out of this? It's not going to work. If I go into the priesthood thinking, you know, I'm going to get stuff, it's not going to work. If I go through life that way, it's not going to work. We go to meet Jesus in our neighbor, in the Mass, to serve. So it's more about him than it is about us. But that is not the way the world thinks. So as you're looking at your faith, as you're interacting with the world, it's important for you to understand the framework that's going to work to give you answers to questions. And let's go back to marriage, okay? I bet all of us know. I mean, who's in their bedroom? But for the sake of argument, we know faithful, monogamous, gay couples. And the two men do seem to love each other, and they support each other. And it has the appearance of marriage, okay? It has the accidents of marriage. It's faithful, it's monogamous, okay? But it's not a marriage. So I can love those guys, and I do love them, but I can't call what they have marriage. And that's the challenge that we have as Catholics, is we need to love our neighbor, but that's not the same thing as endorsing a lie. Does that make sense? Okay. I think the next thing Helen wanted was personal witness, which she kind of covered, but I thought I would give you my take. So I was raised Episcopalian, and the Episcopal Church, I mean, I realized in 1994 that God had been calling me for like 10 years, but I'm a man, so I'm dumb and slow. It took me a while to figure this out. But what it turned out was that I didn't want to be my own pope and magisterium. I didn't want to have to figure everything out. And the Episcopal Church, and I apologize if I'm going to make any Episcopalians upset, they get together and they vote on things. So doctrine is the thing they vote on. And that can't be true, because Jesus doesn't change, so the truth can't change. So it's up to me. And I wasn't comfortable with that. I want to be a sheep. I don't want to be the shepherd. And the Catholic Church is the only faith community that was established by Jesus, protected by the Holy Spirit, entrusted to Mary. And if you think about it, it's the only faith tradition that is built like a family. When I was a kid, I heard this from my father. As a father, I say it to my kids. In this family, if you're going to be a young, you're going to do this. Because I'm your father, and I said so, is eventually how you solve two kids arguing and fighting. We have a papa, and we have a mother. And when we get in a fight, eventually I'll get around a table, and if it comes down to it, the Pope says, because I'm the Papa, and I decided. And so that structure, to me, corresponded most faithfully to the protection of the truth. Because I don't want to have to sit and figure out every single thing. I want to just do the work in front of me. And the Catholic Church kind of answered that for me. Okay? I think that concludes it. Anything else that